Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is music attorney John Kellogg. But first of all, let's talk about some under-the-radar news this week. Apple has filed and received a patent for a new technology that eliminates swear words out of content. So, for instance, it can automatically find a swear word in a song and eliminate it. And the way it does that is by analyzing the song and replacing it with music from the song. So this is kind of cool in that it automatically does it. There's a number of ramifications in this. First of all, this is something that was normally done by mastering. And what would happen is the mastering engineer would usually get two copies. They would get the explicit copy, and then they would get another copy without the vocal, a mix minus, so to speak, or sometimes it's a TV track. And what they would do is just take a little piece from the TV track and drop it in where the explicit words are. And if you didn't have the TV track available, what would happen would be you would beep it out. But this was the domain of the mastering engineer for a long, long time. And of course, a mastering engineer can do it very precisely and very quickly. To do it automatically means that you'd have to do at least as good a job as a mastering engineer. And we don't know because we haven't heard it. The only thing we've seen is the patent on it. This is also supposed to work with books as well, where it could edit out words or even undesirable scenes. The idea would be anything that's sexually explicit can be eliminated so the book is more presentable for children. My question for you is, does this violate the First Amendment rights of an artist? Most artists wouldn't want that to happen. They wouldn't want anything censored. That being said, there's already a fair amount of censorship within Apple. For instance, on Beats 1, they won't play anything that has explicit lyrics. Beats 1, of course, is the Apple radio station on Apple Music. And on iTunes, it's the same thing. They've been very cognizant about porn, and they haven't let any porn apps on the App Store. So, for better or for worse, that's happened. Now, the fact of the matter is, this patent has only been granted, and Apple hasn't said one way or the other whether they're going to roll this out or not. So, in fact, we may be talking about a moot point, something that never gets used, but in fact is a technology that maybe can be used for something else. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I just launched a couple of brand new mini coaching programs called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks and Ultimate Punchy Drum Tricks. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is the six treble frequencies. So this is something that pops up a lot in mixes that I hear. Not so much with A-list mixers, because A-list mixers know about this already, and that's the first thing they look for. But when you find less experienced mixers, you find that a lot of things are muddy or murky or lack definition, and that's because of the six treble frequencies. The first one is 200 hertz. 200 hertz is kind of magic because either it will give you a thickness that you really like, but too much of it will make it muddy. So 200 hertz is one of those frequencies that many times is overused. The next is somewhere between 3 and 600. And this is the frequency that gives you that boxy sound, the basketball sound on a floor tom, for instance. Too much of this, and all of a sudden, there's your boxiness. And you get rid of it, and all of a sudden, it sounds pretty good, and you have definition that you didn't have before. Another one is 800 cycles, which is overlooked all the time. What does 800 cycles give you? Well, I like to call this the Walmart sound. It just makes it sound cheap. So it doesn't matter what instrument, what vocal, what element. Too much 800 cycles just gives you that cheap Walmart sound. And what I mean is it's kind of a cheap audio sound. When you listen to inexpensive audio speakers, you find that there's a lot of 800 in there. Another one that gives mixers trouble is 1K to 1.2K. And this is the nasal sound that you get, especially this jumps out in vocals a lot, where you have too much 1K, too much 1.2K, and all of a sudden things sound very nasally. So you have to be very careful of that. On the other hand, on a snare drum, that gives you the crack. So it works on certain mix elements and doesn't so much on others. 5K is a presence frequency, and many times what happens there is there's not enough of it, so there's not enough definition in the sound. What this does is it gives a shine to the sound, it gives it a little definition, but on a vocal, for instance, you add too much and all of a sudden you get sibilance. So you have to be very careful with this, but it's one of those frequencies that I find is sometimes lacking. And the last one is 10K and up, and this is what's known as air. And the problem with a lot of what we hear is the fact there's not enough of that 10K. A lot of times what you have to do is really crank it hard in order to hear what it does. But what will happen is it will open the sound up. It will give you something that sounds a lot more real. I just had Cliff Mogg on the show not too long ago, and his EQ4, for instance, features an air band, which is especially effective for adding the air in a sound. And you find that all of a sudden it just opens things up and it sounds real. So these frequencies are trouble frequencies in that many times there's too much. In the case of the four lower frequencies of 200 and 300 to 600, 800, and 1K to 1.2K. And there's not enough of the other two frequencies, 5K, the presence frequency, and 10K and up, the air band. So if you're mixing, if you're recording, no matter what you're doing in audio, if you look at these six places on the frequency band, you're going to find that slightly manipulating each one of them will give you something that's clearer and better and more natural sounding. My guest today is attorney John Kellogg, who has represented artists like LaVert and the OJs, and is now the assistant chair of the Music Business and Management Program at Berklee College of Music. He's also the author of Take Care of Your Music Business, The Legal and Business Aspects You Need to Know to Grow in the Music Business. John knows the music business from an artist's perspective as well, since prior to becoming an attorney, he was a member of the funk band Cameo. I spoke with John via Skype from his office in Boston. So I want to go back to the beginning here. I want to hear about you and Cameo.
You want to hear about me and Cameo?
Yeah.
Very interesting. You know, I say I have an it theory, and my it theory is that if you have it, you can make it. But you can't make it without working it. So I found out that I had it in high school. Some members of a group I was managing heard me sing, and they said, John, you can't manage the group anymore. You've got to be in the group. So I said, wow, maybe I can really do this singing thing. So I started singing in my group. We started performing everywhere we could. And then when I went to college, I started my own band, and we worked on the road even while I was in college. And shortly thereafter, I devoted myself full time as a musician, and we worked on the Chitlin circuit. Bobby, you've heard that term, and you know what the Chitlin circuit is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In the northeast part of the United States and parts of Canada. And the Chitlin circuit, for those of your listeners who may not know what it is, was clubs and auditoriums and theaters where Black artists played to primarily Black audiences. And during that time period, while I was working over the course of 4 years with my group based out of Syracuse, New York, we performed in the same town as a group called the New York City Players. And the leader of that group was Larry Blackman, who went on to start the group Cameo. And it got to a point when the group I was in, I suggested we move to New York City, and most of the band members didn't want to do that. So I had to leave the group and went to New York. And the first call I placed was to Larry Blackman, because I'd met him on the road. He heard me sing, and he wanted me to be a part of his group. And it's that day, he said, well, we're in the studio cutting demos right now. John, I'm glad you're here. Come on over. And I went over and I recorded the demos with him. He said, good, you're going to be the falsetto singer on that. We're recording our album. Let's do it. And so I use that example to say that I found out that I had it, and I wanted to be on a nationally released record. That was my goal. That was making it to me. And after 4 or 5 years of performing and really working it, in one day, in one call, I was put in a position to feel like I had made it. So that was my experience recording with Cameo. And I recorded the first album and toured with them shortly just before going to law school.
Okay, well, take me there then. How do you go from Cameo to becoming an attorney? Was it something that you had planned? In other words, did you always want to be an attorney? Or was it just something that came about as you were doing your musical career?
Well, my dad was an attorney. So always in the back of my mind, I thought that at some point I might want to do that. But what really turned the tide for me was when I was on a group with my on the road with my group. From Syracuse, New York, before I got with Cameo. They were called the New Decade. And I read an article in Jet Magazine about an attorney named Larkin Arnold, who had become the first vice president of black music at Capitol Records. And I said, wow, they have attorneys in the music business. Wouldn't that be cool? Yeah. And so it was placed. And then at that time also, there were a number of artists, Dionne Warwick, one of the members of the group called Mandrill, who was a great group
sure.
at that time.
Yeah.
And they both said, if I could do it over again, I'd go to law school. So yeah. all of this was really started to plant seeds in my mind that, wow, if I get the opportunity, maybe I'll do that. And after I started recording with the group Cameo, I had the opportunity, and many musicians may not even have college degrees. But I was fortunate enough to have a college degree and a master's degree by that time. And so I said, look, if I have the opportunity, I've got to take it. And so I took, but it was hard, Bobby. I'm telling you now, it was really rough because I left the group. And at the end of the week, I left the group, to go back to my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, to work in the steel mills for about 6 months before I went to law school. And the week I left, that weekend, the group opened up for Natalie Cole at the Superdome. And, you know, I had done theaters and small clubs. So, you know, that would have been a big gig. So it was really rough.
Yeah.
And, of course, then when the album was released, seeing it in the bins and hearing it on the radio, and I was going to the steel mill every day. But I felt in the back of my mind that it was going to be the best career move for me because my father told me years ago, son, think with a long view. Think about what you're going to be doing 25, 30 years from now. And now it's been 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
And now I'm very happy that I made that move because I've been able to maximize my talent potential as well as being able to make the kind of living that I wanted to make. And I would have never made had I stayed with the group.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should mention that because I'm in Los Angeles and I have a lot of friends that have been in studios, either as musicians or producers or engineers, and they made a very good living. And then when things, you know, hit a downturn, never yeah. quite came back the same way. And it's a shame to see a lot of talented people really struggling and not used to struggle as well. So it's heartbreaking sometimes.
It really is. Well, it really has been since the beginning of this century. And that's one of the reasons why I segued into education at the very beginning of this century. I kind of saw this coming,
yeah.
you know, even as far as being an attorney, and I was a transactions attorney. So many times my deals were contingent upon me. The amount of money that I was able to receive
yeah.
from negotiating a publishing deal or a production deal or an artist deal. And those deals have really, one, the amounts of the advances have drastically been reduced.
Yeah.
And there's just so few of them now that there'd be no way for me to support myself solely in that type of practice. I would have had to have done some things that I might not, other types of law that I might not have wanted to do. So I just felt real fortunate to have gotten into it at the time I did. And I enjoyed it a lot.
I have a good friend who's an attorney and used to represent a lot of producers and big engineers. And when things turned down, he found that he was making more money as a trust attorney, you know, and
yes,
and basically right. that's what he's doing now most of the time.
Yes.
I talked to him the other day and he says, oh, how do they do any music now? But, you know, I'm doing all right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I see I really feel for young attorneys who are trying to do it the way I did it. I mean, there's no way that they can. They have to be doing something else now. And that's unfortunate that that's the way it is in the music industry. And I really thought that it was momentous that at the Grammy Awards, you had Neil Portnow make that statement. And I'm really trying to rally behind NARIS now because they seem to be the organization that I hope will lobby and put pressure on the record companies as well as Congress if you have to go the legislative route to force them to increase the payments, particularly for the digital streaming aspects of the industry.
Well, see, I just did a study of that for a book that's about to come out. It's Music 4.1. It's the fourth edition of one of my books. But I looked at every aspect of streaming down to the thousandth of a cent, where it was going. And there's plenty of money being made. The problem is there's less than ever that's falling down to the artist and songwriter because the labels are catching most of it on streaming. And, you know, again, the deals are such that songwriters and especially songwriters and artists just aren't seeing it.
Yeah, you know, I've read some of your articles, your Forbes articles, and I understand you have a great understanding of that area, and it frustrates me to no end. And that's it. It's really the on-demand streaming where the record company is getting the money.
Yeah.
And then many times, how are they paying? What royalty rate are they going to apply to that? Are they going to pay the 15%, you know, sales royalty rate? And that's really what they're paying.
Yeah.
If but to me, they should be paying more like 50% or the amount that they normally pay for third-party licenses.
Yes.
To me, these types of activities are third-party licenses. And I was a little upset when one of the class actions with the members of the Temptations and others settled recently. And they agreed, they got a, I guess they got a nice payment up front. But they only settled for receiving a couple of points more, you know, like 17% instead of 15%. I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the number, folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, right. And that's the reason why I'm kind of adamant. I spend most of my time trying to advocate on behalf of artists. This, to me, is going to be the issue over the next 4 or 5 years. And I encourage my students to become active and to become advocates for their ability to make money.
But don't you think that that's an aspect of students, especially? I feel that students aren't being taught how to be entrepreneurs. And let's face it, in the music business, you're an entrepreneur. You're making your own gig. You're
right.
Making your own jobs. And even if you get one, it's short-lived. It's only for 2 or 3 or 5 years, and then you're back out, you know. And one of the problems that I see in music courses everywhere is the fact that it's teaching you how to get jobs. It's not teaching you how to make your own job many times. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a good point. We've changed our curriculum at Berklee College of Music. We just incorporated an Institute for Creative Entrepreneurship within our music business management department. And it's led by Panos Panay, who was the owner of why is that name escaping me? The online booking site. I can't think of the name of it right now, but
online booking.
He's doing a what? Huh?
You're not thinking of Ticketmaster or
Sonic Bids.
Sonic Bids.
Sorry.
Okay,
Sonic
right.
Bids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He owns Sonic Bids, but he left the company, of course, and he allowed the company to be purchased, and now he's on our faculty. And he is the director of that and founder and director of the Institute for Creative Entrepreneurship. And that's his point. And in addition, we're teaching students at Berklee College of Music that you can use the creativity that you learn in playing music in all types of activities, in creating apps, in doing other types of activities that can be of benefit to companies that want creative people. So we've kind of changed our focus to do exactly what you're saying. Let these students know that you are a business. There's a lot of opportunities available for creative thinkers. here's how you do it. Get out there and make it happen.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. What do you find students know the least about when it comes to the music business?
Clearly, when I get students in Music Business 101, and I teach that course at Berkeley, they have a vague idea. Some of them have heard the term publishing. They don't know quite what it is. They've heard the term copyrights. They may not, and they've done a little research online about it, but they don't understand all of the underpinnings of those concepts, which we had to explain to them, and the importance of copyright. Copyright, to me, being the most valuable asset in the music industry.
Yeah.
How to protect it. How to calculate, and this is the thing that I really stress, how to calculate the royalties that you're being paid. As I tell them, and I tell my students that I hated math when I was in high school. I took the basic algebra course, you know, of course, trigonometry was offered. And I said, no, I don't need that. I'll never need that. Why would I need that?
Yeah, yeah.
But once I got into music business, I understood you need to understand those equations you need to so that you can calculate what you owe. The record industry in historically, the record companies and publishers and everyone else have relied on the fact that songwriters and artists don't care about that aspect, so they'll pay them and account to them any way they want to. And so I find that there are some of the basic things that they need to understand. And in addition to that, I stress to them the importance of really keeping what I call one of my three big P's for success in the music industry, professional attitude, which I tell them it's very important for them to respect whoever they meet, develop a healthy respect for everyone, from the receptionist, because you never know when that receptionist is going to be the president of the company in years to come. So because you meet the same people going up that you meet going down. Yeah. So if you want to have a long career with longevity, you really have to develop a relationship of respect with all of the people that you meet, including, I tell my students at Berkeley, the students sitting next to you, the students in your dorm rooms, because these people, as I call all of my students, are going to be the future leaders of the music industry and entertainment industry.
You know, it's funny you should say that. So I've been gone from Berkeley since 1980, but there are five ex-Berkeley guys that we get together about once a month and have dinner.
Oh, man.
And they've all gone on to some notoriety, as a matter of fact, but in different parts. You know, everybody kind of starts one way and you end someplace else, but everybody's still in the music business.
Right.
And it's pretty amazing, actually, that we've maintained that through the years.
Right.
And that's one of the things that students don't understand enough about, that, as you say, the person next to you may be integral in your success. Because
At some level. At some point in time.
Yeah. Yeah. The networking is important.
I tell my students a story that I remember when Zomba Music, and you know who Music is, and when they first came, it's a very interesting story. I got a call. My clients, LaVert, had a big record, and the father of two of the members in the group, Sean and Gerald LaVert, Eddie LaVert, who's the lead singer of the OJs, called me one day, and he said, John, I've got a guy named David Renzer that's calling me from this publishing company named Zomba. They want to do a publishing deal. Have you ever heard of Zomba, David Renzer? I said, no, I've never heard of that. I said, I'll check it out. So I called and found out more about the company. So met David Renzer. He says, look, I'm just starting here. We're going to build a big, powerful company. We know we're new, but we really want to get behind. We think that your clients are very talented. And if they sign with us, we're going to give them the best service. As it turns out, they gave us the most money as well.
That helps.
But as it turned out, this company, you had in that one part of that company included Jive Records. I went into their four-story brownstone on Lexington Avenue in New York. First floor was Jive Records. I met Barry Weiss. I said, hi, Barry. He was just starting Jive Records. Mm-hmm. Second floor was David Renzer in publishing. Third floor was Paul Katz, who was their business affairs guy. From that small building, they went on to become one of the biggest independent, one of the most successful entrepreneurship stories of the 20th century in the music industry.
Yep.
Because the owner of that company, Clive Calder, in 2001 or 2002, sold his company, and you know this, to BMG for $2.6 billion.
Yeah.
Now, when that first started happening, they had another guy that came in to assist Paul Katz, another lawyer, Richard Blackstone, whose office was in a broom closet next to Paul Katz's office. And I developed a great relationship with all those guys. Who knew what would happen?
Yeah.
Well, what happened? David Windsor went on to become the head of Universal Music Publishing and is still in the publishing business. Richard Blackstone went on to become the head of Warner Music, Warner Chapel Music. Barry Weiss went on to become the head of Universal, you know,
yeah,
almost the entire Universal Music group at one point in time. So that's what I tell them, that you never know where people are going to end up. This young lawyer, Richard Blackstone, goes on to be, now he's still with BMG Rights Management.
You're right. You just never know. And you have to be cognizant. Well, you know, again, it's the same old thing. Nice people tend to work in this business. If you're nice to people and they like you, you tend to work a lot, you know, and you tend to get the benefit of the doubt. Even if you don't know, a lot of times you're not up to snuff. They'll carry you along if at least they like you. So
absolutely.
You know, well, there's actually a story, a Berkeley story behind that. When I first came to Los Angeles in 1980, I was told in no uncertain terms, don't tell anyone you're from Berkeley. And the reason why was ex-Berkeley students were known to have a bit of an attitude. Mm-hmm. So it would immediately soil the water, so to speak, if you mentioned you're from Berkeley. So one day I went to a session at A&M. It was finishing up, and a good friend of mine was an assistant engineer at the time, and he's gone on to win 17 Grammys. But he was just an assistant So he was a Berkeley buddy, and he was cleaning up and everything. And there were five musicians that were packing up, and we start to talk about Berkeley, and all of a sudden, all the ears perk up, and all one by one. When did you go? I was there in 72. I was there. All of them were ex-Berkeley people, except for one. None of them knew.
Right.
Because at the time it was, you don't tell anybody. And thankfully that's changed. That's now changed.
It certainly has. It's because you have so many people out in the field now that are working at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And that's even what I tell my students if they go to industry events. I tell them to read Billboard magazine every week to put the faces with the names, because when they go to these music industry conferences, they can walk up to some of the behind the scenes people, the A&R reps, the promotion people, the executives at the company, and introduce themselves. And I, you know, behind the scenes people love to be recognized. And I said, and tell them that you're a student at Berkeley. And I said, you watch their ears perk up. And that's what's happened over the years. Because of the reputation of the school, how it's grown, executives will say, oh, you go to Berkeley? And then I said, after that point, you can enter into a conversation with them. You know, I'd like to do an internship. Is it possible that you can help me with that? And so we've been fortunate. I mean, like, I've been here 10 years. I'm celebrating my 10th year here. And we've had just a tremendous growth. And so it is a different world now.
Yeah.
It's a different world.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about your book. What brought that about?
Well, I started to conduct the seminars, which really got me into teaching. I put together an all-day seminar in the middle part of the 90s as I saw the business going toward production companies. Production companies were really running, and to a great degree are still running, the music industry. And I saw a need for young producers who were putting together these companies to really understand all of the basics. So I put together an all-day seminar, which I presented in Cleveland, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan, on the topic of how do you put together a company? What types of entities should you use? You need to have an understanding of copyright. What is a copyright? What do you need to understand about copyrights? What do you need to understand about four of the basic contracts in the music industry: the exclusive recording artist agreement, exclusive songwriters agreement, co-publishing and administration, and the management agreement. And after doing those seminars, I thought, wait a minute, all of the materials. I had a workbook that I passed out, and I said, I need to put this material together in a book that I can actually have published and get it out to the public in general. So that was really the genesis of the book. It took me a few years to get it together. It was first, the first edition was released in 2001. And of course, the second edition, Take Care of Your Music Business, second edition, Taking the Legal and Business Aspects You Need to Know to 3.0, just came out in 2014. But I've been really glad that I did it, and I'm very happy with the success of the book so far.
Yeah, I guess by that time, it needed an update because everything had changed so drastically in the business.
Absolutely. And people, as a matter of fact, people, after I put it in 2001, around 2008 and 2009, I had a chance to be on a panel at Syracuse University. And one of the guys there, one of the professors in the music industry program, he said, well, don't do a new edition now because things are changing so fast as soon as you put it out. So I felt more comfortable after particularly, iTunes really started to settle in. And we were just getting to streaming, like in 2014, we see it developing. We see the subscription services really trying to catch on. That I thought it was a good time to put it together, to project, to not only talk about and update what I did in 2001, but also project 360-degree deals, had really started to go in 2001 when I put out the book. They were non-existent. Now they have really kind of become the basic form of an agreement for most of the major labels.
But haven't things kind of settled in on 360 deals where attorneys like you have now kind of figured it out where it's, well, maybe you guys shouldn't get as many rights as you're looking for? And hasn't that kind of shaken out a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. And what everybody's really looking for is what is the difference that these agreements, 360-degree deals, are making as far as the revenue for record companies. And nobody can put their finger on it.
Yeah.
I think the record company executives, of course, they don't want you to know anything more than what they have. But how successful are these deals? And of course, record companies have always just relied on their biggest artists generating most of the revenue. So I'm sure that for the biggest artists, it is making a difference in their revenue streams. But overall, I don't know what it is. So if you have leverage, and I hated those deals. I really did. I understand the concept, however. Yeah. Where the record company is investing $1 million in putting out your first album, in promotion and marketing costs, recording the album. And if you become successful and promoters want to hire you for live performances where you can make a lot of money, Crest Toothpaste wants you to do a toothpaste commercial. For a female artist, she gets a CoverGirl sponsorship and endorsement. And all of these things, you get an acting gig. All of these things happened as a result of their initial investment. It makes good business sense. But because that had not been the case, prior to that, record companies only participated in the recording, earnings generated from the recording. It was just too new and too drastic of a change. So I think lawyers are adjusting to that. And of course, the great thing is you don't have to have a 360-degree deal if you have multiple companies that are buying to enter into a contract with you. You have the leverage to say, well, if you want me, you can have me, but only for recording earnings and only for the recording area. Everything else you do not participate in. And some major record labels that just want to have the hot artists, from what I've been told, I haven't done any of those deals, but from what I'm told that, and from what I understand, that has been the case in certain deals for certain hard artists that have a lot of leverage.
But, if you look at it from, just step back and look at what today's record labels do, they do a lot less than they have in the past, where once upon a time, you needed them for distribution of product to get out. And you don't need that any longer because they're doing it digitally. The majority of it anyway is digital. The one thing they do give you is the infrastructure for marketing if they choose to put the money that way, or if they,
Yes.
So that's worth it just because you can't reinvent the wheel on that scale.
Right.
But
right.
Other than that, they're not getting you the Crest commercial, for instance. That's probably the manager that's getting that, right?
Well, yes, but what these major labels are doing, they're really developing departments within the companies that are really reaching out to these companies for sponsorships and endorsements. And some of the major labels have purchased some of the management companies and kind of brought them in-house. So they're really trying to put and become what I call entertainment companies rather than record labels, because they're dealing in all kinds of aspects. I remember doing a deal for a client years ago, right after with Shady Aftermath, which is, of course, with Universal Group Interscope Company. And it was right after Eminem had his big hit movie, 8 Mile.
Yeah.
And this is when I first, this goes back to the early part of this century. And this is when I first became aware. I got the draft of the contract and had a provision saying that if you develop a movie based on your life story, or you want to act in a movie based on your life story, you have to give us the first opportunity to develop that product. And I said, wait a minute, where is this? And it was the beginning of the genesis of the 360 degree deals here in the States.
Yeah.
And as you know, Interscope also happened to be a movie company as well. So they developed their product. It became successful. So anyone, new artists that were being signed, they're saying, look, if you're going to do a movie, you have to give us the opportunity to do it first.
Well, it kind of makes sense at Universal, because they do have that ability to take you over to the other division. Right. And Sony too.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Where do you see the music business going? If you looked out 5 years from now, where do you think we're going to be at?
My hope is that subscription services will catch on. I'm kind of pleased that there has been a difference in my students. 2 or 3 years ago, I'd ask students in a class of 90 students whether or not they subscribe to digital service, on stream, on demand streaming service. And I might have maybe 5 to 10 in the class, but now I have about a third to 40% are subscribing. And I
paid subscription, right? Paid subscription, you mean?
Paid subscription, yep. Yeah. Paid subscriptions to on-demand services like Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal, or some of the other services that they have. And I attribute that to Spotify's $5. They have a student rate of $5 a month. And these kids are buying into it. And I'm glad to see that. So my hope is that people will buy into the subscription service in the kind of numbers that will enable more of the money to be paid, for there to be more money to be paid from these services to the artists. Now, the problem, as we talked about earlier, is the record companies in the middle, and they're collecting the money, and the amount of money that they're going to pay the artist is the thing that really needs to be renegotiated, as far as I'm concerned. But I think if we get up to 80 to 100 million paid subscribers to on-demand streaming services, there should be more than enough money to make up for the shortfall that we're finding from the decrease in sales of albums. If that doesn't occur, I don't know what the future will be. So I am hoping, and people are saying that they think that that could happen within the next five. They first thought it would happen before 2017. It's not happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm hoping that maybe we get to 2020 to happen. And I remember back in the 70s when cable TV was first started, paid cable TV, HBO and some of the other services, and everyone thought it was ridiculous. They wouldn't pay for it. And it took about 20 years for cable to reach 100 million subscribers. No, not, I think it was only 53 million or 60 million. Well, within about 10 years, it took until the 80s before they were able to get up to about 53 million. And now they're up to 100 million. So I'm hoping it won't be that slow of a process. Certainly in with the speed of development now of all things digital, it shouldn't take that long. I hope it doesn't, and I hope that's the way it'll go.
I just saw today where Spotify is now up to 28 million paid subscribers. So
what?
28 million.
Today?
Today, I just saw that.
Yeah. I'm so glad. I heard the last figure I got was just the other day, because they announced that Apple Music had 11 million,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, right.
And they said, and Spotify had 20 million. So you're right. I think Spotify then decided to come out with new numbers. And I'm so glad to hear that because that means, like, well, look, we're almost up to 40 million with those two services alone. So I think that, and this is what I try to tell my students, that we're going through a period now that other than live music, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for producers. It's going to be tough for songwriters. I really feel for country songwriters at this point. I love country songwriters. I love Nashville because those men and women go to the studio every day, 9 to 5, knocking out songs. That's all they do. But unless their song is a single and they have multiple singles that are hits, they aren't going to be able, and they aren't, I don't think, in a position to make a decent living. And from what I've heard, there's been a number of songwriters, career songwriters, who have had to go out and try to get other gigs because of that. And I'm afraid that that might continue until we get to the point where we get up to 60 or 80 million paid subscribers. And we renegotiate how much the songwriters and recording artists are going to get from that 70 or 75% that Spotify claims they pay to the record companies and publishers. How much of that money is going to be allocated toward the paying the songwriters and the recording artists?
What scares you about the music business?
Nothing.
I love that answer.
I'll tell you why. This is the one thing I love about the music business, and this is why I tell my students it'll never die. The music is a heart-to-heart connection. I say people gotta have it. They gotta have it. They have to have that feeling that only music, and to me, even live performance, can give them that thrill, that inspiration, that emotion. And so it's just a matter of figuring out how you can make money from it. The live music, as you know, area is booming. Now it's booming primarily for the big artists, but there's still a lot of artists out there that can work. And that's always been the case. You know, when I first started in the industry, we didn't even think about money from records. We didn't think about me making any money from records.
Yeah.
We just used the record for promotion to make more money on the road.
Yeah, right.
And so that hasn't changed, and I don't think that will ever change. The only thing that I worry about that scares me is the effect that it's having, particularly on people who can't go on the road. Songwriters who have the talent to come up with creative, clever, different melodies and very clever lyrics, like, to me, the Nashville songwriters do so well. To me, that's a national treasure and an economic boon for the United States that economically we can't afford to allow that to happen for that class of individual, a class of great songwriters to be eliminated because they can't afford to make a living.
Yeah, I agree with you. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you ever either learned along the way or received from someone?
I think that you have to keep the proper perspective. You have to understand that you don't get rich. You don't get in a position to be able to make a living from this business overnight. It's something that takes time to develop. And you have to have the proper perspective in thinking that I'm going to invest a lot of time. I'm going to invest a lot of energy. It's going to seem like it may not be paying off. And this is what I tell students that are in the industry right now, that, yeah, it's going to be, it might be, the music industry's always been tough, but you have to hang in there. And if you hang in there and you have powerful product, great songs, great live performances, you're going to be all right in this industry. You're going to be all right. That was the best advice I got. Just think with a long view.
Yeah.
Think about longevity. I've been fortunate enough to have represented clients like the OJs that have been in the industry 55 years. Guys are 74, 75 years old, still out. They were at a casino here in New England just last weekend. Gerald LaVert had a 22-year career. You can have a long career, but you have to keep everything and look at everything with a proper perspective.
Well, we think alike in a lot of this. And that's why I enjoyed speaking with you today.
I've enjoyed it too. And we're going to have to call each other, man, and just talk.
Yeah, man. Yeah, no, this is great. This is great.
I come out to LA, we got to have lunch.
Yeah, yeah. Please do. That'd be great. That'd be great. Yeah. Thanks so much for being with me today. I enjoyed the conversation. I'm glad we got a chance to do this.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You can find out more about John at KelloggLaw.com. That's KellogLaw, all one word, KelloggLaw.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at EDMMR.com. Steve puts the show together. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.